Nachum Segal here in a segment that we call By the Book here at the Nachum Segal Network. I want to thank our friends at Koren Publications who continue to not only provide the world with incredible publications, wonderful books, but continue to provide for us amazing authors, fascinating people to speak with, to get insights into their incredible work. And today is no exception. Today we have the opportunity to explore the book entitled With All Your Possessions, Jewish Ethics and Economic Life. It is a Magid Books release, which of course is an affiliate of Koren Publications. You can check out all the information at korenpub.com, korenpub.com. And the author of With All Your Possessions is our guest this hour. Dr. Meir Tamari is director of the Center for Business Ethics and Social Responsibility in Jerusalem. He is author of In the Marketplace, Jewish Business Ethics, The Challenge of Wealth, A Jewish Perspective on Earning and Spending Money, and Al Chait, Sins in the Marketplace. The brand new book is With All Your Possessions, Jewish Ethics and Economic Life. Dr. Meir Tamari, welcome to the Nachum Segal Network.
Thank you very much.
There are many people out there who are very glad you've written this book, because many people out there feel that one of the areas where the Jewish world is sometimes lacking is in areas of Jewish ethics and economic life. Do you have any theory why this specific area of halacha and Jewish observance has often been too neglected?
Well, it's not a theory, it's just a fact. You see, after the emancipation, all religion, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, all abdicated the whole area of politics and economics to the secular world. And they all became religions. If you look at the Christianity in the Middle Ages, Islam, they all had legislation with regard to economics and economic law, etc. They all abdicated this. And it's only in about, I think in the last 40-odd years that we've been able to turn the clock back a bit.
Interesting. So this is not what some people would call a Jewish problem. It's a worldwide problem.
Well, it only bothers us because we're Jews.
Right.
So that's if you have a look, the Catholic Church kept quiet for 150 years. And then the bishops published their pamphlet on poverty in the 1960s. And all of a sudden, those issues of justice and poverty, etc., etc., became religious issues. And the same thing happened with us.
Right. Dr. Meir Tamari is with us. With All Your Possessions is the name of the new book. I always thought that that one of the reasons why this area was somewhat lost in Judaism was because there are those who in our tradition emphasize the activities that are responsibilities between us and God. And there are others who often emphasize the activities and responsibilities who are between us and man. And this area seems to be somewhat of a hybrid, seems to be somewhat of a combination, maybe without the flag bearer that you might have when it comes to the other two categories. Is there any reason to think that I might be onto something?
No. I'm sorry. You see, the phenomena that you're speaking about is only a phenomena maybe of the past 100 years.
Right.
If you look at any authority in Judaism, Sephardi, Ashkenazi, anybody, early Hasidic Admorim, you will find that there is no separation between the two. It's a false separation which was brought about for a simple reason. Religion to us, Judaism, has become like other religions, a personal matter. You're religious, I'm not, I'm less observant, you're more, etc., etc. I belong to Church A, and you belong to Church B, or to Synagogue A. And that's as far as it goes. You mustn't forget we were talking about 150 years ago,
right,
when religion meant everything that you did.
Right.
And this separation, by the way, this separation is really comfortable. You understand why?
It makes for a much more comfortable existence when you don't have to
yes,
work.
Yes, of course. I can do what I like, make my money, and be a pious man. It's easy. It's a wonderful system.
Right.
By the way, there's something that you, I think, was lost. By profession, I'm an economist.
Right.
And my last position until I retired was the chief economist in the office of a governor of the Bank of Israel, which is your Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know which one came first, but I found in the 1960s already that we were teaching economics at Bar-Ilan University and YU everywhere as a separate discipline. And then the guys were learning Bes Medrash. One thing had nothing to do with another. In other words, I would talk about bankruptcy or corporate investment as an economist, and then I would talk, give a share of something. And that seemed to me to be a false separation.
Yeah, I understand that. But academically, we have students that pursue, you know, biology and organic chemistry and are not necessarily dealing with medical ethics in the same course as well.
No, but you see the same problem exists there, but I don't deal with optics or biology.
Right.
I've claimed all the years that the same mistake is being made there. But in economics, I could do something about it. The same thing, a boy who learns Beis Medrash at YU anywhere, learning social welfare. That's a discipline which is very much judgmental and based on certain psychological or value system. And for a religious guy to be a social worker and apply the social values of an outside society at the same time as he's busy in a Beis Medrash seems to me be a split personality.
Understood. What about those who come from the other angle? I understand what you're saying in terms of those who are in secular academics and you know, have to, as you're insisting, have to make sure to include, you know, the Jewish contribution to that area. But what about the opposite? What about those who spend their time exclusively in the Beit Midrash? How about them?
The same problem exists.
They also
the
have
same
to...
same problem exists, that they see the Jewish involvement as a separate compartment of their lives, and then they exist in the outside world as businessmen, lawyers, or accountants, or whatever you like. If you have a look at any of the writings of Hirsch, who prepared us for the modern period, you will see it appears again and again that there isn't such a separation.
One has to go with the other.
Of course, that's Judaism.
Dr. Meir Tamari is with us. The book is called With All Your Possessions, Jewish Ethics and Economic Life. Is there, therefore, a way to describe the Jewish attitude toward the way we're supposed to deal with money? Is there a specific theme that one can come up with to describe how what Jewish behavior means in the marketplace?
Definitely. Is there? Would you be surprised if I asked you that question? Is there any specific Jewish way of our food? You would say, of course there is.
Right.
Right?
Correct.
Cautious.
Correct.
Right. The same thing applies to your money. The only difference is that with regard to kashrus, there are altogether 613 mitzvot, 28 commandments, 24 of kashrus and another 4 of chadash, the new wheat in our time.
Right.
Total.
Right.
I counted 120 of tariyach mitzvot, of the 613 mitzvot, which have to do with my money. And then I stopped counting. It was enough.
You know why I continue to pause as you're speaking. I am thinking about how lost we are on this issue, and it took my conversation with you today to open up my eyes to that. I mean, statistically, what you just said is mind-boggling compared to kashrus, which is regarded as one of the most important aspects of Jewish existence. So statistically, it's one thing, but it seems like we're not just lost in this area. It seems we don't even start to approach this whole area.
Yeah. So right, I agree. I've been saying that for 50 years, but I agree with you 100%. Let me give you an example.
Please.
A man, a woman, a Jewish man or woman die, like, okay, 120, and then they come to the next world.
Right.
So what question does God ask of them? It's simple. There are simple two Gemara, one in Shabbat, which talks about, they ask him if he learned Torah. One question. But in Sanhedrin, there are 10 questions. And the first question is, did you deal honestly in your business?
Right.
The first question. It doesn't mean, were you honest? Because, as Aruch HaShulchan explains, for that we have all mitzvot and dinim, etc., etc. It asks if a person did his business life with the understanding that God provides for the needs of all people, of all creatures, as we say in Ashrei, Poteach et Yadecha. A person who lived his life without that kavanah, that's the first question it is asked. There is no question about kashrut of the 10 of them. They didn't ask him whether he ate mahatuin or klat or anything. That's a separate issue. I didn't say he shouldn't eat. You follow me? I'm not saying that it's not important. It is important.
Can one, just like at kashrut, do tshuva in this area? One who is not a kosher eater could change his life and literally, make sure that 100% of his future menus are kosher. Can one make the same type of transformation in the area of economics in Jewish law?
Most definitely. If you look at any of the prophets at this time of the year, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Amos, etc., etc., they keep on telling us that.
We had
a period now between Shavuot, Sabbath, Tammuz, and Tisha B'Av, right?
Right.
Period of Churban. It's interesting that none of the prophets came to complain that the temple service wasn't in order. That was the Jews were very careful to do the Tamid until the very end. So what Yeshayahu, read the first chapter, what he wants from us, which we'll read on Shabbat Chazon.
And one of the things our prophets remind us is examine how we deal with the widows and the orphans.
Exactly.
And if we would go ahead and implement some of your suggestions and some of your analysis, would that lead to a better attitude toward those who are underprivileged?
Now, one thing must be clear. I've never claimed, and I don't claim in that book, that is the Jewish way. The Jewish way with capital T's.
Right.
I am suggesting that it's a possible Jewish way. Somebody who doesn't agree has to come up with his own suggestion.
Right.
The field is open.
But just to go back to my question, if we were more careful about some of the guidelines you discussed, would it in fact improve our attitude and our actions when it comes to the underprivileged?
Definitely, because everybody, when a little boy or girl learn Mishnayot, they all learn about Masechet Sukkah, and then they learn that they have to go and build a Sukkah.
Right.
Or they learn Psachim, learn about Pesach, you've got to make a Seder, you can't eat Chometz, etc., right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's children or adults, men or women, They all end. And yet, with regard to the three bobot, Nizikin, we've made it into sort of study, you know, somewhere up in the world between man as an ox and, of course, the other ox. And it's just, nobody wants to understand that it's as much Torah as the rest of the stuff. Chashem Mishpat is part of Shulchan Aruch, just like Or HaChaim.
No question about that.
Oh, no. I think it is a question, but yeah.
For some people, it might be a question. Some might be listening and wondering if the wealth that's been amassed by the Jewish world collectively in our time makes this even more difficult or presents, you know, even different challenges. But it seems to me, based on our conversation so far, that the volume of wealth may not have the effect on all this that we think. Is that would you agree with that?
I'm not clear what you're saying.
I came into this conversation assuming that in a generation like ours, where there's so much wealth in the Jewish world and where disposable income in our community, I assume, is much more than ever in history, that these regulations, so to speak, this way of life would be a greater challenge.
Of course it is. That's why Chazal tell us that the challenge of poverty is much weaker than the challenge of wealth. A poor man can afford to be poor. He's nothing to lose. A rich man has a lot of problems. We tell him you can't make money. Like somebody once interviewed a book of mine, a non-religious Jew, and he said that he was taught as a young boy there are certain foods that Jews can't eat. But he wanted to eat non-kosher food.
Right.
And then he came to Washington. And in Washington, gossip was the main merchandise, and they tell him Judaism said you can't just talk gossip. So at last he thought that at least his money was his own. Came to Murray and told him you're wrong. Simple. This is a generation, not just Jewish. The world generally, after the Second World War, became more prosperous than at any other time in the world. Even the poor in India aren't the poor in India 30 years ago.
Right.
And that's why it's a challenge. So it's a challenge to a guy who's putting together a billion-dollar deal that he should be careful that should be Jewish if he's a religious Jew. It's a much bigger challenge than if he was a little shopkeeper who was selling a packet of cigarettes.
Understood. I'm sure there's some ethical challenges in that as well, but understood. If someone wanted to incorporate, because we're talking about, you said it was over 120 mitzvot of the 613, right?
Yes.
So if someone wanted to incorporate and seek your advice of how to take a small step, I think I could advise someone if they asked me how to slowly get into the world of eating kosher food. I can make certain suggestions about what they might want to adjust at the beginning of that journey. If someone asked you, how do I incorporate slowly some of the things that you talk about, where would you start them?
Firstly, there's the field of halakha. He has to go to his rabbi and ask him, I advertise like this, is this permissible? I hired workers and I want to do this sort of deal with them. Am I allowed to or not allowed to? That's the first step. There are logic questions in all these things. But the halakha in this field, like in every other field, we don't teach our children to keep Shabbos only halachically.
Right.
So why should we do that with our money?
There's the spirit of the law as well.
There's the spirit of the law. There's a vasita that man should do within the limit of the law. A man should do that. There's a pasuk. A man should do that which is just and true.
So when I ask the question about leading somebody, you say that they have, you know, everybody has a rabbinic leader. They should consult with them, get a halachic direction.
Which is what you're telling with regard to kashrut as well.
Correct. But it seems therefore, that you're not ready to Paskin Shilas, as we say, in these areas. You're simply there to discuss the areas of interest in the topic of Jewish ethics and economic life.
You've got the wrong address. I've been doing that for many years.
But
the answers aren't always what people want to hear.
Right. So therefore,
for instance, there's a famous story which maybe isn't famous anymore because it happened 25 years ago. There was a Jewish businessman in Boston whose name, we don't even mention the name, who had a clothing business inherited from a grandfather. And they had a fire. So what do people do if they have a fire and the factory burned down? You fire your workers, right?
There's no work for them.
Right. This gentleman, Boston Jew, said that his grandfather taught him that there's a Jewish way to do business. He paid the salaries of his workers for about 2 years until they reconstructed the factory.
Right.
So the Wall Street Journal writes that he did it cleverly. You see, he wanted to buy employee loyalty. He was doing that because his sabbat told him that there's a Jewish way to do business and that employees aren't like a disposable object.
And that story certainly had international impact, that's for sure.
Definitely.
But the reason I gave the introduction I just did about being a decisor when it comes to Jewish law is because someone like yourself I'd be curious to ask about one of the most well-known topics out there when it comes to economics and the Jewish community, and that's the payment of taxes to one's host country. Let's dismiss for a moment Israel from that conversation, but let's deal with the...
No, even Israel. Your question applies to large sections population with regard to Israel as well.
And you would conclude, I would guess, that there's no question that no matter what country they're in, including Israel, one should be participating in the taxation procedure.
I suggest that anybody who has that question should open the Shulchan Aruch, open the Rambam, and see that the payment of taxes and duties and levies to a legally established government. We're not talking about a dictatorship or an evil government. We talk a legally established Gentile government. If a person doesn't bear that thing, this is theft. And it makes sense, because if I don't pay my taxes, I'm doing one of two things, or maybe both of them. Firstly, the other guy has to pay more.
Right.
And secondly, part of those taxes are used for the public good.
Right.
I don't know how much we won't argue about that, but it's used for roads and for welfare and for education. If I don't pay my taxes, I'm stealing that money from those people who receive it. Can't be simpler than that.
I must ask you the following, because I'm so curious about your perspective, and I hope you're willing to give a definitive answer. We have a concept in this country that's been thrown around for a very long time, certainly for the last 20, 30 years aggressively, about a flat tax. No matter how much you make, whether it's $5,000 a year or $5 million a year, everyone should give the same 10% or whatever the percentage is to the government for services and everything else you just described. Many others, of course, and the way this country works right now, are demanding that if you are making more money, you have to take on a much higher burden, and therefore we have people making the millions of dollars who could be paying 50% or more in income tax. Do you have a Jewish way of looking at this issue?
I told you my way isn't the Jewish way.
Right.
So I'll give you a number of approaches. I have a colleague in New York. A rabbinic figure, a learned, a very great Talmid Chacham. He is a major believer in the free market.
Right.
How do you reconcile an unlimited free market with Judaism? It's And what he does is has his first person mentality. That's economics and his Judaism. I argue that as far as I can see in our sources, rich people have to pay more. Simple as all that. It's, if you're so rich, then you have to take on yourself the burden of the poor and the ignorant and the crime, poverty, etc.
Right.
The Lubavitcher Rebbe, I was born for bringing with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, said that there won't be peace to the Jews unless the Noach have peace. And we have an obligation to teach them how to handle crime and how to handle poverty so that they should live in peace. He was talking about American society.
I wonder what he would say about the welfare system of today, which seems to be taken advantage of, or at least from the perspective of those who are full taxpayers, often think that it's being...
That was always a problem. People didn't all of a sudden start to get clever. It was always a problem. So the sources say that in the same way as you are obligated to give, it depends what the issue is. If a man comes, look at the Shulchan Aruch, Rambam, if a man comes to me and he says he doesn't have what to eat, one is not allowed to check if it's true or if it's a liar. Because until I check, things can happen. One of the Hasidic leaders said, why is there no bracha for giving charity?
Mm-hmm.
Mitzvah.
Right.
He says, if it would be a bracha, everybody would be concerned with the legal things, when to say it, what to say, how to say it, go to the mikveh first, etc. By that time, the poor guy would die. So, that's but that. But if a man comes to you and says to me, he doesn't have a suit to get married in, the issue perhaps becomes different. Even then, there is a question, a rich man, but please notice, a rich man who became poor, I'm obligated by halacha to give him even a horse, sign of honor, to ride on,
right,
to ride before him.
Right.
But why? Because our sages understood the psychological harm which is done to a man who was once wealthy and now became poor. It's different than the suffering of the poor man.
Correct.
The poor man never had any better. And this guy sits and worries to himself, oh, what I was. Right?
Yep.
The same logic applies to an unemployed worker. The same logic. A guy had a job and now he's, what do you say, he's unemployed or dispossessed,
right,
or redundant. The most shocking word in the language. You tell somebody he's redundant. Society says you're redundant. I don't want to be redundant, nor do you.
It makes the Rambam's attitude toward finding employment for somebody even stronger, because you'd have to assume that at some point everybody's been employed. So you want to make an effort to...
We want to break the poverty cycle.
Right.
It seems the biggest... I don't know. I have a big problem. Charity never broke the poverty cycle. Nobody became middle class because he got charity.
Right.
Poverty, charity keeps poor people poor. Welfare keeps welfare recipients on welfare.
Right.
So therefore we ruled, we have take a guy, lend him money, should start a business.
Mm-hmm.
But a nice thing about it is that business will be in competition with me.
And that's what people are concerned about often. Especially when it comes to the topic of immigration.
No, listen, children is one thing, but we can't make a children out of everything.
Right.
Separate issues. For instance, it's a well-known principle of Judaism that there are two issues with regard to lending money at interest. Two separate issues.
Mm-hmm.
There is one, the fact that your Jew is not allowed to take interest from another Jew, with the heteresco, all the halachas, but the, and nobody wants to see, there is another mitzvah, I have an obligation to lend you money interest free. And I have that problem in my life. I was very careful not to lend money to interest, but I never lent anybody money interest free, so I didn't do my job. The interesting thing was that generations of Jews, probably your great-grandfather, my father, and somebody else's uncle, came to America and South Africa and England, and they couldn't borrow money from a bank.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it was anti-Semitism, but not altogether. They came, they couldn't speak English, they had no track record, they were bad creditors. No bank manager had the right to lend the money. But the man wants to be a business. He's a hawker. He buys a truck. So what did he do? He went to Gemilat Chesed. They lent him money not to make a party. They lent him money to go into business. Knowing full well that the guy, because that's a Jewish way of doing business, he sees that you're doing nicely selling coats. So he opens a business selling coats. You just helped me compete with you.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way life was. So we have an obligation. We have widows and orphans and poor people. We have an obligation to give them the education, the money, the help, the advice, even if it's not money. Poverty isn't just a question of money. It's a question of knowing how to handle your money.
Dr. Meir Tamari is with us. The book is entitled With All Your Possessions, Jewish Ethics and Economic Life. Our thanks to Koren Publications, KORENPUB.com. It's a Magid Books release, a fascinating conversation on the topic of Jewish ethics and economic life. Dr. Meir Tamari is with us. You mentioned earlier about your role as an economist with the Bank of Israel and your career with that institution. I'm so curious... if you don't mind me asking, going off topic just a bit, we see how strong the Israeli economy is today, at least compared with some other Western countries. And I don't think anybody who knew Israel in detail in the 60s, 70s, 80s, etc., would have ever dreamed that we'd be talking about a stable economy which is looked to as a strong one in this world. But what are your impressions of how Israel's economy became like that?
If you would look carefully, you would see that the Israeli economy is like it is because of the foundations laid in the same socialist years. The reason, major reason, there are plenty of technical reasons, etc., for people, the governor of the Bank of Israel, Stanley Fischer, others who understood, but as important is the fact that we never dismantled regulation to the same extent as Britain and France and Germany, and United States never had the same degree. So that when the crisis hit, the economy was able to withstand it because of that fact. The Israelis are in the main homeowners.
So you
right?
need a happy medium. It can't be
Excuse me. The reason why they are homeowners.
Right.
Why? Not only because we're cleverer and we bought real estate and the non-Jews didn't buy real estate. That's not true. I mean, it is true, but that's not the only reason. There is another reason. Because the founders of the State of Israel didn't want to create a landlord class here. They didn't want that I should come and build the housing for rental and make a living from another guy. They wanted me to be able to buy my own house.
Right.
So they didn't allow building for rental.
They encouraged purchasing it.
Yes. So it introduces other problems. I don't want to... It wasn't correct, but I'm just saying the way of thinking.
Right.
It introduced problems in the economy. It also... mistakes and waste and all that. But essence, we started after 1985 to dismantle the welfare state that we had. It needed cutting back. It was not a good system. But it didn't need throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And the government wasn't allowed to throw the baby out because public opinion was opposed to it.
Right.
So they didn't cut back welfare as much as they would have liked to. They didn't cut back education and health. Believe me, we had plenty of architects who wanted to do that, like the rest of the world. They didn't, and that's why one of the reasons why the economy is better than in most other countries.
When I mentioned earlier the happy medium, my point was it sounds like there are elements of what the American economy has been over the years, and the capitalist, I assume you mean, the capitalist attitude and activities that we've undertaken here. You need some of that, and as you indicated, some of the socialist principles that Israel was founded with. It sounds like if there was a happy medium, one can create what has been created in Israel.
I don't know if there was a happy medium. This struggle which has been going on for about 3,000 years. But as far as making money and having property is concerned, Judaism is a free market economy.
Right.
Right?
Right.
To make a profit isn't like it is in Catholicism. Rich men, by the way, if you ever thought of it, that our leaders were all rich men.
Correct.
Abraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, Moshe were rich men.
Right.
There were no poor little disciples running around.
They were men of means.
Many, much means.
And King Solomon had a great number of means.
Right. Now, but at the same time, there's a question of how you make it and how you spend it.
Right.
That's not a free market. It's not a happy medium. Judaism is a religion on 2 feet. Well, remember what Hillel thought the guy came to ask him about 1 foot? Shammai said it isn't such a thing.
Right.
You can't have one issue Judaism.
Kosher
money, like kosher war, like kosher sex, like kosher food.
Someone said to me over the weekend they were frustrated with the way that somebody spent money at a wedding, you know, in a very ostentatious manner and setting aside a tremendous amount in order to have the wedding, and then said that they were somewhat placated when they found out that same gentleman had gone ahead and paid for poor bride's weddings in Jerusalem to coincide with his own child's wedding. Does that at all temper the situation when one's dealing with with the immense amount of wealth, or one has nothing to do with the other?
Now, I don't like to talk about hypothetical cases which I don't know about.
Okay.
So let's keep the record to the source. Until 100 years ago, every Jewish community had regulations limiting to what you could do with your money in simchas and everything. As a matter of fact, it's a fascinating area. There were communities that said, you want to have a son and making a brit. What is your situation in the communal tax roll? If you're paying a high tax rate, you can invite 20 people to your brit. If you're paying medium tax, you can only have 15 people. Below that, you can have 1 million of Jews at your thing, and you can't serve tea and coffee because in the 18th century, these were luxury items. No tea, coffee. You can do with your money what you like. Not in Judaism.
Wow.
I'm sorry.
Dr. Tamari, this has been a very enjoyable session for me. I greatly appreciate it. Good luck with the book, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Meir Tamari, the book is called With All Your Possessions, Jewish Ethics and Economic Life. And he certainly had some amazing insights, that's for sure. Dr. Tamari is director of the Center for Business Ethics and Social Responsibility in Jerusalem. Dr. Tamari is author of In the Marketplace, Jewish Business Ethics, The Challenge of Wealth, A Jewish Perspective on Earning and Spending Money, and Al-Chait, Sins in the Marketplace. Magid Books offers new approaches to Jewish texts and themes from the world's leading rabbis, scholars, and philosophers. Magid is an imprint of Curran Publishers Jerusalem. Magid proudly publishes Dr. Meir Tamari's book entitled With All Your Possessions, Jewish Ethics and Economic Life, and all the information, of course, if you go to KorenPub.com. Again, that is KorenPub.com. You can get all the information and enjoy their incredible offerings that you will find online. And I thank Curran Publications. They, again, have provided for me an amazing author and somebody as a guest who has written a fascinating book, Dr. Meir Tamari. I thank him again. Thank you, Curran Publications. The segment is entitled Buy the Book, and you're listening to the Nahum Segal Network.